This podcast is intended for investment professionals. This week, we're talking about what the nomination of Christine Lagarde means for the ECB and, more broadly, why leaders matter when it comes to central banks. Joining me to talk about this theme are senior European economist Hetal Mehta and strategist Chris Jeffrey. Thanks to you both for joining us today.
Thanks for having us.
Thanks, Mark.
It comes down to this, in my mind. Does a change in leadership, such as Christine Lagarde at the ECB, materially affect the market's expectation around monetary policy?
I think it does. It obviously will depend on the institution, but for a key institution in Europe, especially when given its institutional setup with a number of different countries relying on one institution to set their monetary policy, it really does matter to have someone who can drive the debate, who can set the policy agenda, sometimes maybe bring on other colleagues who are still hesitant, as we saw with Mario Draghi. He was quite pivotal in the sovereign debt crisis for Europe.
So a figurehead who can really bring, who can inspire leadership from across the institution and, in the case of the ECB, the institution's members on which it relies.
Yeah, I think that's really, really important, particularly when you're looking at potentially looking at unconventional policy. You have to have the ability to persuade people convincingly that the course of action you're about to take is genuinely the appropriate one.
Chris, persuading people within the confines of the ECB's mandate must be quite difficult considering how constrained they've been over recent years. In your previous episodes, you've talked about how quite limited the ECB is in enacting unconventional policy measures.
Yeah, but it's limited in quite an interesting way. Its limits are political rather than legal or institutional.
So perhaps having a politician at its head is precisely what they need right now.
Exactly. So the ECB is ECB's independence is backstopped by an intergovernmental treaty, which is phenomenally hard to change. So that puts the head of that institution in a position of autonomy, which is greater than the autonomy in principle, which is greater than the autonomy we see in almost any other major central bank. But there are political constraints that come with the inevitable trade-offs of implementing, as Hetal's kind of pointed out, one monetary policy regime across a monetary union made up of different member states with different conditions and different optimal policy at any one point in time. So somebody who can navigate the kind of corridors of power is probably more important at the ECB than somebody who can navigate an Excel spreadsheet or a very complicated piece of new economic or econometric theory.
And so with that in mind, what is it that Christine Lagarde is really bringing from her experience at the IMF? Is it that case of small p political navigation? But she's been in that role for many years at the IMF. What can that teach us about the next steps? Is it Mario Draghi's policies continued, or can we see can we expect quite a traumatic shift?
So, given her comments while she was managing director at the IMF, very dovish comments, sometimes even appearing to outdove Mario Draghi himself, I think we can expect her to continue with Draghi's dovish tilt. She might not want to go for unconventional policies right from the off, and maybe what we're going to be seeing from the ECB in Draghi's final days will be setting in train some stimulus so she doesn't have to make any big decisions in the first few weeks or months that she's there. But it will be a continuation of that emphasis on shoring up credibility, trying to use the biggest range of tools that the ECB can possibly deploy.
Fun fact about Christine Lagarde is that she was a member of the French national synchronized swimming team, so we can assume she's going to go with the flow. I'm here all week. I think the kind of I guess it's important that the IMF has not just been a detached body pontificating about European policy from the outside. The IMF has been deeply integrated, in particularly the Greek bailout and debt restructuring. So I think the thing that she will bring to the job that is potentially new is an attitude towards towards countries in, we hope we don't get there, but there's a scenario where countries in Southern Europe get into financial distress once again. And it's the potential actions in those scenarios which I think are where you would have the most meaningful difference between different types of policymakers. Yeah. And if her approach is going to be kind of grounded in pragmatism rather than ideology, and the kind of whatever it takes approach to keeping the euro together under those moments of stress, I think will definitely be healthfully informed by having somebody who was so integral in those kind of debt restructuring debates and bailout debates in the past.
And keeping the euro together, very much a political project and a political problem to have to solve in that instance, which requires that resilience that we've seen from Mario Draghi, would you say?
Yep, I think there is certainly an element of resilience that's needed. You know, Christine Lagarde, as Chris said, very much involved in the Greek negotiations. And also just being open to new ideas is going to be really important. So maybe the fact that she's not a trained economist actually keeps her more open-minded. She's not wedded to a particular school of thought or any type of orthodoxy. And that open-mindedness, I think, will probably be to her advantage.
I think that provides a really interesting comparison to the last major central bank change of leadership, where investors were quite worried that Trump would nominate someone too political in this instance. What does this tell us about investors' different views of the major central banks and the expectations we have of their leaders? You just mentioned how Christine Lagarde perhaps doesn't come with such a economic orthodoxy. How can we compare this situation to the case of Jerome Powell?
In some respects, very similar. So Powell is the first chair of the Federal Reserve who doesn't have a PhD since the 1980s, sorry, PhD in economics since the 1980s. Christine Lagarde's a lawyer. He's a lawyer. Christine Lagarde has a kind of political background as a former French finance minister. He has a political background as a former undersecretary of the Treasury during the Bush years. Mm-hmm. So, you know, as a kind of template, the kind of, maybe it sort of says the, and Hetal's going to reach out and hit me for this, but, you know, the era of economists is maybe passing to the era of lawyers in charge. And given the kinds of constraints that are being imposed on central banks by the very high profile kind of tensions that sometimes emerge between the ECB and the German government, for example, given the very, very high profile tensions that exist between the Federal Reserve and the White House, maybe kind of having lawyers in those positions isn't such a bad thing.
Hetal, is the age of the technocrat done?
Not entirely. I do agree with Chris, though, that obviously there is, particularly in the current environment where we have increasing populism, that maybe people fall back onto what the legal constraints are for institutions as a kind of anchor for kind of going forward in policy. And so to that extent, you will need someone that is more well-versed in understanding the legalities of different policies and being able to navigate that. But I guess at the core of it, you will need a kind of economic anchor or a rationale for doing what you want to do. So the legality will help you in what you need to do in terms of the implementation. But in terms of the rationale and maybe quantifying how much policy response is needed, I think you'll still need economists.
What can we understand about the situation, as you mentioned there, the tensions between the White House and the Federal Reserve, perhaps, about central bank independence in the way that we have quite an independent ECB and the Federal Reserve is independent by law and yet can so and is under such pressure from the executive branch of the US government?
So the way I think about this is the Federal Reserve reports to Congress. The nominations for who's going to sit on the board come from the president, but under the Federal Reserve Act, it's very clear that it's a statutory duty to report to Congress. So, for example, kind of the wording on how the chair is chosen says that there's a person designated by the president, but with the advice and consent of the Senate. So it's advice and consent. The Senate has kind of the ultimate power here. You know, there's this kind of old saying that the U.S. presidency is the bully pulpit. You couldn't really think of a better personification of that phrase than the sorts of actions we've seen in this area over the course of the last 12 months. So, yes, there's very, very considerable public pressure to enact a certain kind of policy. Mm-hmm. But the very reason we have independent central banks, I think, is exactly this kind of environment. It's where political motives would dictate a certain policy, and that will be policy aimed at engendering stimulus that is effective in the very short term to suit an election cycle. And you have independent central banks try and kind of look through that. And you know, where they have a clearly established democratic mandate answerable to the legislature rather than the executive. You know, you just need powerful enough individuals, strong enough individuals to kind of withstand that pressure. And I think we have that in Jerome Powell.
So could we say then that despite them not having a direct impact, the executive, they have a massive indirect impact, perhaps over the course of monetary policy and the central banks. And therefore, that's, as you were saying, Chris, why these personalities, the strength of personality, matters so much.
Yeah, I think that's absolutely right. You kind of think about the UK situation. Again, it's kind of similar in principle institutional setup. The governor of the Bank of England's an appointee of the Treasury, but then answerable to Parliament through the Treasury Select Committee. So the oversight and kind of accountability is to Parliament, mm-hmm. but in some sense, there's sort of a whip hand at the Treasury in terms of the appointment. We just kind of go back to my previous answer. Why do we have this institutional arrangement in the first place? Why don't we have a world in which politicians directly set interest rates? I mean, the answer is we tried it. It worked out really, really badly when that was the setup, because politicians would set interest rates to make themselves get reelected. Mm-hmm. That's not sort of a very... It's not a very kind of complicated dynamic beyond that. It's that we want to kind of take the kind of sweetie jar away from the kids in a way and kind of put it on a shelf where they can't reach it. That's kind of the point of the system that we have.
Yeah, I would agree that governments can have very big influence indirectly. And to kind of carry on with the UK example, if you take Brexit, the Bank of England has to assume government policy, which is currently to have a deal with the EU, and their forecasts are conditioned on that assumption. No matter how low a probability that may be or how high a probability, as that fluctuates, the Bank of England's base case is always contingent on government policy. And therefore, again, directly or indirectly, they are influenced in the way they communicate through those forecasts and the risks around them. And that can steer the debate and ultimately the way markets interpret the reaction function of the central bank.
Completely. So it's about those forecasts and what those forecasts are predicated upon, the data that's coming out as ultimately from government bodies, the executive overall, the legislature. And so that will have a natural impact of what does monetary policy look like in the future. To take that British example on a little bit, there is a lot of speculation about who will be the person to replace Mark Carney at the Bank of England, with a new prime minister confirmed today, actually, as the time of recording. Are we likely to see a sharp change in policy at the bank in the future in a post-Carney world?
In the very short term, I wouldn't expect the Bank of England to take a sharp turn in their policy. The biggest uncertainty obviously hanging over the economy is still the outcome of Brexit. And until that is resolved, there's not a lot that the Bank of England can do. They've kind of signalled through the course of this year that it's a big risk. One thing that they have come out and said more clearly than in the past is that should there be an adverse impact on the economy from Brexit, that they are more likely to cut rates than to increase rates. But in terms of the decision-making process, it is still done by committee. The governor is highly influential, but it's still done by committee. And we have to remember there are four external MPC members on as part of the nine who are going to be less beholden to exactly what the governor instructs them to do. So I wouldn't expect a sharp shift in the short term. Over the medium term, that's clearly something that could happen. We've had, for example, the Labour Party have talked about giving the Bank of England a different type of mandate, maybe a productivity target. That would certainly change the dynamics and also the tools that the Bank of England would have to deploy.
I guess over time, in the context of central banks around the world, perhaps the Bank of England is probably one of the last to turn that bit more dovish in the way that we've seen the Federal Reserve, the ECB kind of turn in that sense.
Yeah, they've had high inflation, partly because of the weaker pound having fed through. Inflation expectations have been more anchored than we've seen in the US and particularly the Eurozone. So they've had less reason to turn more dovish. But that said, we know that the economy is under pressure from the uncertainty, and they can't remain completely immune to what's going on. So where we have global growth concerns related to trade wars, China slowdown, European slowdown, you know, the Bank of England can't remain immune to that, and they might be the last to turn dovish for very good reasons. But ultimately, in a world where everyone else is loosening policy, it would be very difficult for them to hike policy.
Interesting. And so, to Chris, perhaps to take this back to kind of nuts and bolts of who is mooted as the replacement. If they can't, perhaps are limited by these economic conditions that the world finds itself in, yet who is the person to make that decision as it stands now, not to run the betting markets out of business, of course?
You kind of want the shortlist of runners and riders for the Bank of England job. There's a UK economist sitting to my left who I hope has put her name in the frame. I think it's a slightly pointless exercise to kind of do this kind of who might it be, because it is, you know, we are, like as you said, we're kind of recording this episode on a day when we're changing the leadership of the country. We're changing then almost certainly. Well, actually, not almost certainly, because the Chancellor has now resigned. We've got a new Chancellor by the end of the day. So we don't know, you know, the individuals who are going to be making this choice. Mm. The assumption has got to be that that there's a sensible kind of process and institutional infrastructure here, which means somebody well qualified for the role, and somebody well qualified for the role means, I guess, as we've kind of, you know, learnt in the ECB and the Fed's case, it doesn't have to be somebody with a PhD in economics, but it should be somebody who has got experience of managing a large, diversified, complex financial institution. Mm-hmm. I'm not going to kind of engage in kind of speculation about which of those names might come forward. I think the thing that kind of is most important is, does that person respect the principle of the independence of the monetary policy from the political process? And if not, and I've got no reason to think that it would be somebody who doesn't respect that principle, if not, then the kind of, what are the quite hard lines that distinguish developed market monetary policy from emerging market monetary policy start to blur a bit.
Could we use Turkey perhaps as an example here? I mean, that seems to hit the nail on the head of exactly what happened when the leader really came after his central bank leader.
Yeah, I guess Turkey has kind of been body blow after body blow for the independence of the central bank. You have a president who has theories on the way that interest rates transmit into the economy and inflation that are highly unorthodox, would be the polite description. So believes that higher interest rates cause higher inflation and that the way to bring down inflation is to bring down interest rates. I think there is a very, very, very small body of opinion which agrees with that, but he's the president of the country. Arbitrarily sacking central bank governors, kind of trampling all over their ability to kind of set policy in a way that will sensibly kind of anchor expectations about the future. And Turkey pays one of the highest interest rates on its local government debt as a result. It has a chronically weak exchange rate as a result, and is subject to kind of recurrent concerns about capital flight and the stability of the banking system. And Now, I don't want to kind of be alarmist. Those are not our expectations about the UK or the US or the Eurozone. But you just sort of worry once the institutional kind of protections that have been built up over 70 years start to fray, you just kind of worry about where it might end.
Mm-hmm. So really much more of a warning sign of not the future of the death of the independence of the central bank, but certainly an extreme example of where degradations of this institutional strength can lead.
Yeah, and it's examples that have played out time and time again in emerging market history. So we kind of go back to the 1940s. Argentina was a country that was as wealthy per capita as France. You know, throw in 40 years of populist rule, mismanagement of fiscal and monetary policy, and Argentina is now a reasonably impoverished emerging market as a result, from a starting point that was extremely, extremely solid in the 50s.
The challenges for leaders of the central banks of the past, I mean, we're going back to the 1940s there, obviously, are obviously very different from the type of challenges they're going to have to face in the future, from regulation to just your standard monetary policy in the next recession. Where will the personalities of Christine Lagarde, Jerome Powell, and whoever replaces Mark Carney really come into play, Hetal?
So I think the key thing will be, as I said earlier, is about having an open mind. And, you know, every recession, every crisis is different from the previous one. But for me, at the moment, it feels that where the kind of role of the traditional central banker was to bring down inflation, to kind of anchor inflation expectations, is why we had the introduction of inflation targeting. We're now in a position where actually for many countries, inflation is significantly below the target. And it's having the tools and also the conviction to drive up those inflation expectations. And that's clearly the big challenge, particularly for the ECB at the moment.
Yeah, and I think it's a difficult one because it's not the sort of same kind of acute crisis moment that you have as a function of that. So when you kind of had the Greek debt crisis, the UK financial crisis, you know, there are moments of acute decision-making need that, you know, that a decision needs to be made in the next 24 hours or Lehman Brothers is going to go bankrupt or, you know, are we or are we not going to provide support to Northern Rock during the financial crisis? Are we or are we not going to flex our rules to support Greece in the next 24 hours and otherwise the banks collapse? Whereas this is just a different type of beast. It's a sort of slow-moving kind of chronic problem rather than an acute problem. The chronic problem being that inflation expectations have just been on this very slow slide down towards zero. They're not at zero, but in that direction. And the hard bit is there's no kind of like single moment where people need to make a decision and say, well, this is, if we don't make a decision by tomorrow, the house of cards is falling over.
Yeah, there's no hard deadline to spur people into action. So it's can almost be kicked down the road. The can be kicked down the road again and again.
Yeah, exactly. Again and again and again, we can kind of, you know, delay decisive action. But then you sort of end up in the Japan-type problem. So Japan, we're now, what, 25 years, I think, since inflation hit zero. And ever since, it's been described as a temporary phenomenon that would, you know, soon be self-correcting. 25 years, still waiting, guys. You know, so you know, we kind of talked a lot about current and future central bank governors. The one that I kind of like the most on these kind of topics was Ben Bernanke. You know, he said back in 2002 when talking about these kind of issues, is the best way to get out of trouble is not to get into it in the first place, which is very profound. but I think that's the sort of attitude that you're starting to see emerge, certainly in the US now, with this pivot towards much looser policy on the back of no meaningful kind of slowdown in growth. You know, you kind of hear that sort of echoed in his own sort of different language by Jerome Powell. And again, in kind of his own language, you're kind of seeing that kind of echoed by the Mario Draghi attempt to preempt this collapse in inflation expectations. But it's hard because there's not a sort of, you know, backs to the wall, 5 minutes to midnight type moment at any point.
Perhaps the way to sum up this conversation, perhaps for me, is then while economic circumstances or governmental pressure, as we discussed with Trump, can often influence central banks' leaders' actions, it's the personalities of who's in place, perhaps at that, you know, the 11th hour make a decision, can make a huge difference for investor expectations of how a central bank operates both on a day-to-day basis within its mandate and in unconventional terms. Would you perhaps agree with that, or tell me I'm wrong?
No, I think that's exactly right. So I don't think it's the would they raise or lower interest rates by 25 basis points more than the next guy or the next lady. It's about how would they act when push comes to shove. It's you're kind of deep in some as yet unknown crisis, and you need kind of policymaking on the fly, sometimes pushing the boundaries of what has been done in the past and what is kind of even legally acceptable. And that's where the kind of personalities kind of matter. It's can they drive the agenda? Can they innovate? Can they, you know, bring enough people along with them? It's not about, you know, would Christine Lagarde have a trajectory for interest rates that is 25 basis points lower than Mario Draghi? That's kind of irrelevant, I think.
Okay. In an ideal world, it shouldn't matter. If you have transparency, a clear mandate, and a huge array of tools, then it really shouldn't matter about personality. There's a, you know, a whole kind of range of options that for markets should be quite easy to interpret given set of circumstances what happens. But unfortunately, there is very little transparency often in decision making, and as I said before, every recession is different, every crisis is different, and so actually personalities do matter.
Perfect. I think that's a really good note to end up on. Well, thank you so much for joining us today, Hatil.
Thanks, Mark.
And thanks to you, Chris.
Thanks, Mark.
And thank you very much for joining us. If you'd like to find out more about Chris and Hatil's latest views, be sure to read our blog, Macro Matters. Thank you very much for listening, and see us again next week for more ELGIM Talks. If you've enjoyed listening to this podcast, you can leave us a rating or maybe even a review if you're feeling particularly generous on the Apple Podcasts app. It really helps new listeners to find us, and we're always on the lookouts for new ways we can improve. As a reminder, this podcast is intended for investment professionals and shouldn't be shared with a non-professional audience. This podcast should not be taken as an invitation to deal in legal and general investments. Any views expressed during this recording belong to the individuals and are based on market conditions at the time of recording and do not reflect the views of Legal & General Investment Management. Legal & General Investment Management is authorised and regulated by the Financial Conduct Authority. For full terms and conditions, please visit our website. And remember to share this podcast with your investment professional friends, colleagues, or even family members. And to find more great content from Legal & General Investment Management, check us out on Twitter, LinkedIn, and our website.